This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The pandemic has a new hot zone, Southeast Asia.
You'll have people signing up for a vaccine and their appointment gets canceled because the government just doesn't have enough vaccines. And so a lot of the anger comes from the overpromising.
Here in the U.S., immigration detention centers became COVID hotspots. Detainees were appalled when people who look sick were transferred in.
How can we trust these people? Like, how?
Now many detainees don't trust vaccination programs. Also today, one of Fidel Castro's signature catchphrases,
Patria o muerte.
Homeland or death, has been updated as a pop song chant for democracy on the island. I'm Marco Werman, and lots of American kids are suddenly speaking with English accents.
She started doing that last year when she was two.
All because of a pig. That and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Good to have you with us this Tuesday. Who is in charge? That is a question many Haitians have been asking following the assassination of their president, Jovenel Moïse. Now there seems to be some clarity. Today, Claude Joseph, the prime minister who took control of the government following the assassination, he said he's stepping down. And Ariel Henry, a neurosurgeon and politician, is stepping up. Widloa Merancourt is the editor of the Haitian news outlet, Ayibo Post, and joins us in Port-au-Prince, the Haitian capital. Widloa, after so much uncertainty and confusion, how did Haitian officials come to this arrangement to form a new government?
Well, there is a lot of questions regarding this very government. What happened is Mr. Ariel Henry was selected 2 days to become prime minister by the former president, Jovenel Moïse. Mr. Henry, a neurosurgeon, is very close to PHCK, which is the party of the previous president. But what happened is, if you see the composition of this cabinet, it is filled with folks who are very, very close to this PHCK party. For instance, you have Claude Joseph. He was the prime minister, but he's back to this government as Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So a lot of people are criticizing this government, saying it's the continuation of the same old government of PHCK, and there is nothing new there.
What role did the U.S. and other foreign countries play in advocating for this new leadership?
Oh, I think it's a critical role. I think nobody will argue that if it was not for the intervention of the international community, we would not have this government here. I mean, what happened is right after the assassination, Claude Joseph resigned 2 days before the assassination as prime minister, stepped in to fill the role. And all the way until recently, he was talking about building a government. But something happened. We don't know quite frankly what happened. And the international community make a U-turn and says that, oh, actually, Ariel Henry is supposed to continuing with building his cabinet, which is something that he was doing before the assassination of the president. So the international community plays a role, but this role is very criticized. If you talk to people in civil society, a coalition of at least 300 organizations got together to say that they set up a committee that will select the new president and the new prime minister of the country. So seeing the role of the international community, not listening to folks in the civil society calling for change, calling for a new government, calling for something that is more inclusive, and having their voice not being heard, is something that is being very criticized here.
So what is the prognosis then for Prime Minister Ariel Henry bringing some stability to Haiti in the midst of all this?
Well, I think he got a lot in his hands. His major concern right now is to sort of strengthen his leadership and his power, because he's questioned by a lot of people, and a lot of people don't consider him a legitimate government. But what is legitimacy anyway? Because you don't have anything in the constitution or anything in the laws of the country that says how you should run a country when virtually every democratic institution is dismantled. But he has a lot of things in his hand. You have the security climate that he has to deal with. You have the humanitarian crisis that is becoming dire. You have the fuel shortage right now in the country. You have the election. Because you still have to hold elections, right? We don't know yet what is coming, in which agenda he would bring, but what we think will happen is there is no possibility, and I don't think the international community is pushing for it right now, to have election in September.
Widlow Merancour, the editor of the Haitian news outlet Ayubo Post, speaking with us from Port-au-Prince about the formation of a new government in Haiti. Widlow, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In Peru, at long last, a president, officially. Pedro Castillo, a former rural school teacher, spoke before thousands of supporters in downtown Lima last night. More than 6 weeks after Election Day, it was declared that Castillo won the race by a hair, just one quarter of a percentage point. Castillo is the son of illiterate farmers from Peru's northern Andean highlands. It will be the first time he holds public office. For more, we have the world's Latin America correspondent on the line, Jorge Valencia. Jorge, why did it take so long to have the official results?
Well, Marco, because that's how long it took for elections officials to sort through claims of voting fraud. Castillo's opponent, the former Congresswoman Keiko Fujimori, issued a litany of complaints of irregularities that we now know were unfounded. So many see that this now official result is a repudiation of the establishment that Keiko Fujimori represents. I spoke with Javier Portocarrero Maish. He's the executive director of a think tank in Lima called the Social and Economic Research Consortium of Peru.
Esta elección, que es un voto por el cambio, sobre todo uno ve un patrón muy diferente.
Portocarrero Maish says that the official result to him represents a vote for change, because Pedro Castillo, he's a member of a party that is rooted in Marxism and Leninism. So for a country that is as conservative as Peru is, for voters to vote for a member of that party, it means that people are really asking for a major economic change in the country.
Mm. So politically, as you said, Jorge, Castillo is very different from mainstream politicians in Peru. Also, Castillo's background as someone from a rural and largely indigenous area is not common among Peruvian politicians. How much was that a factor in the elections?
I think that it was a big factor. Pedro Castillo is the first candidate in recent memory to come directly from rural Peru to the presidency. And he won largely on the support of rural areas. He won by a landslide in some parts of the Andes, some parts of the Amazon, where a lot of people like him, who might be farmers, who might come from indigenous backgrounds, are from. I spoke about this with Juan Carlos Gallirgos. He's been studying race and ethnicity in Peru for years now, and he's a professor at the Catholic University at Lima.
He's a rural teacher. He's from an Indian background. And so he is part of the underdogs, to say it in an American way. So I think people identify with him easily.
Now, Marco, I think it's worth highlighting that not only was Castillo's background a factor in the support that he got, but it was also very likely a factor in the opposition that he received. The claims of voting fraud focused almost entirely on mostly indigenous areas, which is where Castillo got most of his support from.
But I'm wondering, Jorge, with such a thin margin of victory nationally for Castillo over Fujimori, a quarter of a percentage point, will there be Peruvians who won't see his victory as a mandate to govern?
I think that there already are. I mean, what some political scientists say is that they believe that something similar to what we saw in the U.S.'s election is what might happen in Peru, that some people might continue to say, we think that the vote was stolen and therefore he is not our president. And also, Keiko Fujimori has a lot of political capital. Her father is the former president, Alberto Fujimori, and this is the third time that she comes within an inch of becoming president herself. And it is very likely that she herself will continue to present opposition to Pedro Castillo.
So, Jorge, now that there is an official result, Pedro Castillo is president, what are voters saying about this man who will officially become president on the 28th of July?
I think, Marco, that people, whether or not they support Pedro Castillo, I think a majority of the country is just relieved to have certainty and to know who the next president will be. I spoke with Selene Prado. She is a university student in Lima, and here's what she had to say.
Yo voté por Pedro Castillo porque los peruanos realmente creemos que el Perú necesita un cambio radical.
Prado says that she voted for Pedro Castillo and that she wants to see a radical change in Peru. Now, Congress is divided among many parties, but the people who voted for him, they say that what they want is radical change.
The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia on the final official result of the Peruvian presidential race, Pedro Castillo, the victor. Jorge, thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome, Marco.
Jorge will be back later in the show to tell us about the latest pop song of protest in Cuba. The European Union, once again, is denouncing Poland and Hungary, both countries accused today of restricting press freedoms. Nothing new there, but now a Polish proposal on TV licenses could put some independent news networks in greater jeopardy. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
Independent news channel TVN24 has been broadcasting in Poland for 20 years. The network is partly owned by the US media company Discovery. It's the largest US investment in Poland. TVN24 has also been a thorn in the side of the Polish government.
Bruksela mówi, że sytuacja sędziów w Polsce pogarsza się i że ma wątpliwości.
That's a recent news report questioning the independence of Poland's judiciary. The channel also regularly highlights corruption and human rights abuses. Earlier this month, the Polish government put forward a proposal to close TV networks with majority owners outside of Europe. Now TVN24 could lose its license.
TVN is quite powerful here. The democratic public watch it and are influenced by it.
Piotr Stasinski is editor-in-chief with independent newspaper Gazeta Wyborcza. He says there's only one reason for this proposal.
The government wants to silence TVN, even risking an argument, serious one, with the US.
Daniel Fried is a former US ambassador to Poland. He says he's baffled by all of this.
Why would the Polish government be picking a fight with the United States at the same time that it's fighting with the European Union about issues of independent judiciary, picking fights with Brussels and Washington when we all have a problem with Vladimir Putin and his aggression does not strike me as the best course of action.
Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki says the proposed law isn't about punishing the US.
Otóż wyobraźmy sobie taką sytuację, że jakieś medium w Polsce miałaby być kupiona.
Imagine if some media outlet here in Poland was bought by Russia or China, he said. Shouldn't Polish citizens have a right to say no? But it's not the first time that TVN has been targeted. In 2017, the government threatened the network with a huge fine, accusing it of promoting illegal behavior by showing footage of anti-government protests. A year later, the then US ambassador to Poland, Georgette Mosbacher, warned Polish lawmakers that Washington had its limits when it comes to Poland banning foreign media ownership. A recording of her meeting was leaked to the press.
They realize what an important ally you are. However, that can go up in smoke if anything with the freedom of the press, it's black and white. Congress, they won't tolerate it. Just be aware.
Newspaper editor Piotr Stasinski says intimidation of the media in Poland started right after this current government took office.
First thing they did was to take over the public media, Polish radio and Polish television. In 2 weeks they did it, in the end of 2015.
Stasinski's own newspaper is facing 75 lawsuits right now. Most of them are disputes with the government and its allies. Stasinski says he will not be silenced by legal threats. But Paulina Smivel from Reporters Without Borders says many journalists in Poland do feel intimidated, and she wants the EU to step up.
It's very important that there is an international response to this. It's important that the European institution react and condemn anything that will weaken media pluralism in the country.
The US Charge d'Affaires in Warsaw has tweeted his concern about the Polish proposal. But former Ambassador Daniel Fried says he's confident the issue can be resolved.
Hopefully, we can reverse this dynamic. And I've talked to people in the Biden administration who are aware of the dynamic and are taking steps to try to fix it.
Things could be worse for independent media in Poland. The country comes in at number 64 on the Press Freedom Index that's compiled by Reporters Without Borders. By comparison, Hungary, another EU member state, has been cracking down on news outlets for years. It's ranked at 92. The US, by the way, is 44th on the Press Freedom List. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
We'll be right back. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A lot of little kids are busting out curious accents these days, talking like they're from England. It seems the culprit is Peppa the Pig.
I'm Peppa Pig. This is my little brother George. This is Mommy Pig.
The British accented cartoon that has become a favorite of lockdown kids and their parents who need to distract them. Dominique Wellman is one of those parents. She noticed her daughter was speaking just like Peppa. Dominique, welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us, if you would, about your daughter. When did you notice that she was speaking with a British accent?
She started doing that last year when she was two. We had decided to travel to Oregon, which is a few hours drive, and thought, let's try a cartoon and see if she enjoys cartoons to kind of keep her busy. And that's when she kind of became enamored with Peppa Pig.
Give me an example of something she said with that British accent, or like a word that she's chosen that is not typically in her vocabulary.
Oh, yeah, she says quite a few. She would call me Mummy Pig. That was one of the favorites. She still to this day refers to Santa Claus as Father Christmas.
Dominique, what have you noticed generally about how your daughter has developed language skills? Does mimicking Peppa the Pig follow any pattern?
Well, when she was about two, she was still having issues with speaking at all. And when she started watching Peppa Pig, it really helped her develop language. And initially, it was not unique sentences at all, like you and I would speak to each other. She would directly speak only in sentences from the show, so just direct lines from the show. And it started to develop from that.
Wow, that's pretty remarkable. So in some ways, I'm guessing you must love Peppa the Pig.
I do. It's not my personal favorite television show, but it did a lot for my daughter. And I'm going to love it all forever because of that.
I'm just wondering, though, what was it about this series, Peppa the Pig, that your daughter loved? I mean, the only thing that she's ever really dialed into as a cartoon.
God, I don't know. That's a good question. You know, they're very short. It's like 10 to 15 minutes per episode. It's very bright and colorful. And she would try to climb up to the TV to touch them, to get into it. She was so obsessed with this television show. And no other show interested her at all.
How do you feel about your kid speaking with a British accent? Do you suddenly feel oddly inferior?
Well, she definitely is cuter than I am, and that's totally fine with me.
So, you know, I saw Let It Be when I was 10. For several months, I thought it was cool to talk like Paul or George. It didn't last very long, though. How long do you think the Peppa the Pig accent syndrome is going to last for your daughter?
You know, she still speaks with it when she speaks about the show, but it lasted fully for at least a year. So I think it does go away just with being in an environment that's not, you know, like we're not in an English household.
Dominique Wellman is dealing with a daughter who has started speaking in a British accent thanks to Peppa the Pig, the cartoon. Thanks very much, Dominique. All the best.
Thank you.
Last year, a lot of COVID hotspots emerged within enclosed facilities, places like nursing homes and prisons. Also, detention centers run by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Now, infections at ICE facilities are on the rise again as vaccination rates remain low. The World's immigration editor Monica Campbell reports that the situation is worrying public health experts.
Krim Golden couldn't believe what was happening. It was March 2020, and he was in ICE custody in a remote part of Alabama. COVID-19 fears were rising, and it alarmed Golden that new detainees who seemed ill were being transferred inside.
At the time, you know, everybody's scared, and we didn't have cleaning supplies or any quarantine methods.
So Golden and another detainee protested the transfers by threatening suicide.
So it's like hitting an emergency button.
Other detainees recorded it.
What happened? What they doing down there?
The audio breaks up a bit. It's a bad connection.
They're not caring. They got three positive tested for the coronavirus in here with us. They brought them in here today while we were sleeping. And they
officers stopped the transfers that day, but it was just one of many protests around the country as COVID outbreaks at ICE facilities became more and more common.
How can we trust these people? Like, how?
And this is nationwide from facility to facility.
Golden's distrust of ICE and the people in charge of detention facilities is common among detainees. And it's making it even harder to manage the rise of COVID infections. Currently, only about 30% of detained immigrants have gotten their first vaccine shot, well below the national average of 60% and lower than the rate at federal prisons. At the same time, ICE facilities are filling up again. Today, there are about 27,000 immigrants in custody, nearly double from March as more migrants are detained at the U.S.-Mexico border.
It's a very dangerous time for any detention setting to be increasing the flux of people and staff into the buildings.
Homer Venters is an epidemiologist on President Biden's COVID-19 Health Equity Task Force. He says the situation did improve last year after ICE was ordered to release immigrants. Now, as the number of detainees is going back up, Venters is worried about the process of getting them vaccinated.
It's kind of a mass offer, and then everybody in the housing area either takes it or signs a refusal. But in there, there are actually people who have really legitimate, normal questions. Questions about, you know, their medications or their medical history.
It was nearly mid-May when Karim Golden was offered a vaccine at the detention center in Alabama. He had questions, though, because he'd already been infected by the virus and he was still feeling ill. But he says there was no one available to answer them and he didn't have ways to get informed. He said no to the vaccine.
We're in a vulnerable situation and people don't talk to us as if we're human or have the common sense or even the care that they should have to say, well, you know, let me explain this to you.
ICE didn't grant an interview for this story, but Ed Gonzalez, who might become its new leader, recently told Congress at a confirmation hearing that, quote, health and safety is paramount. He said he wants to make sure certain standards are being met. ICE is also being criticized for lacking a culturally appropriate vaccination plan. Teresa Chang is an ER doctor working with a project at UCLA that tracks COVID-19 deaths among detained and incarcerated people. She takes calls on a medical hotline set up for immigrant detainees.
Individuals have told me that they were offered the vaccine in English when they only spoke Spanish, so they didn't even understand what was being offered.
Core Civic, a private company contracted by ICE to run many detention centers, said that it was working to enhance vaccination procedures as needed. It did not answer questions about providing information in languages other than English. One good sign is that ICE is now building up its own vaccine supply. For months, it's been up to each detention center to secure doses from local officials. Now that ICE has its own supply, vaccinations are increasing, but Chang says that the agency needs to do more.
With this trend of detentions, it's nowhere near enough. We're in for a world of hurt.
Some immigrant and public health advocates say there's just no way for detention centers to be safe during a pandemic. Serene Shabaya leads the National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild in D.C.
People should be out in the community where they can get vaccines and they can be with, you know, families, they can have support structures, and they can pursue their immigration cases that way.
For now, the Biden administration appears to be heading in the opposite direction, placing more immigrants in detention centers while attempting to increase vaccinations. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
We've got more coming up in the second half of the show. You're listening to The World. Just a few days left before the games begin in Tokyo. For the first time, surfing will be at the Olympics. Hawaiians who invented the sport are conflicted about what that big stage means.
Really, surfing is about sharing aloha. It's about taking care of our oceans and reefs, and it's about taking care of each other.
We'll ride that wave a little later here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. I hate to bring up school on a summery mid-July day, but across the globe, there is a lot of anticipation about what classrooms will look like come fall. In East Africa, in Sudan, there's not just pandemic uncertainty, there's also uncertainty about what students will be learning. That's because a major effort to reform the Sudanese education system has sparked controversy. Some see proposed changes as an attempt to remove religion from school curricula. Here's the world's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi, with the second part in our series about religion and nationalism in Sudan.
In a widely circulated video from earlier this year, a Sudanese imam named Muhammad Al-Amin Ismail gives an emotional sermon during the Friday prayers.
لصف السادس الابتدائي كتاب التاريخ التاريخ.
He holds up a sixth-grade history textbook and turns to a page on the European Renaissance. There is a picture of the creation of Adam, the famous painting by Michelangelo. They justify the depiction of God in human form, decries Imam Ismail. For conservative Muslims, that is prohibited. The imam begins to cry, and so do worshippers in the mosque. Close the schools and cancel all the classes, says Imam Ismail. He went on to blast the government official he said was responsible for this offensive content. That was Sudan's new director of the National Center for Curriculum and Educational Research, Omar Al-Garai. I spoke with him at his office in Khartoum.
The Muslim Brotherhood, which are supporters of the overthrown regime, they always, whenever they have any problem, they go to the mosques.
Garai's been at odds with conservative Islamists since his school days. Under the dictatorship of Omar al-Bashir, he fled abroad to the U.S. and only recently came back during the uprising of 2019. When Bashir was ousted from power, Garai accepted a government job to reform Sudan's school curriculum with one goal in mind.
To beautify the curriculum from all negative ideas, negative Islamic ideas.
And to modernize Sudan's education system. Garai says the Bashir regime destroyed it by imposing strict religious ideology on the curriculum. Mohamed Al-Amin El-Toum agrees. He was the first minister of education in Sudan after the revolution. He says the school curriculum needs to reflect the values of the uprising, freedom and equality.
We wanted a curriculum that would help liberate their minds, you know, show them that there are others, there are other cultures, there are other perspectives, but we don't decide for them. We should not try to indoctrinate.
El-Toum and Garai created a committee to reform the school curriculum across Sudan, from kindergarten to the sixth grade. Garai told them to remove all verses of the Quran in every school subject that isn't religion. In the previous curriculum developed under Bashir's rule, even subjects like science and math were full of religious language.
Instead of saying that the earth moves around the sun, they said there is day and night because God creates day and night, and then they bring the verse from the Quran.
But the Quran isn't enough to explain basic scientific concepts, says Garai. After a year of revisions, the new school curriculum was launched in 2020. Criticisms quickly followed from all sides, not only from religious conservatives in line with the Bashir regime, but even moderates who had supported the uprising against him. At the sprawling Hajj Yusuf Mosque in Khartoum, worshippers young and old wash their feet before prayer. School is out now, but children of all ages are here for their religious education. Sheikh Abdulrahman Hassan Ahmed Hamid is the head of the mosque. Sheikh Hamid says he was harassed and monitored by the Bashir regime for supporting the uprising. He says it's his religious duty to fight all kinds of injustice. But now, Hamid is taking issue with some of the changes from the new government in Sudan. He explains how earlier this year, he and other religious leaders and politicians went straight to Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok's office and called on him to fire the education official, Omar Al-Garai. Sheikh Hamid took issue with the creation of Adam picture and how the new curriculum was dramatically reducing the number of Quranic verses that students had to memorize. To him, the government was making all of these changes without consulting all parts of society, including religious leaders. I spoke with one parent at the mosque, Muhammad Hassan Muhammad, about his concerns. He has three children in school. Muhammad says he supports separating religion from science, math, and other subjects, but he says students should still learn about religion and memorize parts of the Quran. And Garay was making too many changes on that front. Mustafa Abdul Ibrahim, a 20-year-old architecture student, also had mixed opinions about the education reforms. It's good to learn about European history, Ibrahim tells me, because it was largely missing from the old curriculum. But teaching controversial things to kids, he adds, is bad. Even though dozens of educators were behind the new curriculum changes, Omar Al-Garai faced most of the heat. He says he even received death threats.
They just talk about me that this guy, Omar Al-Garai, he's an infidel. He wants to make our children non-Muslims.
As the backlash grew, the prime minister temporarily paused the new curriculum and called for a review. That was a breaking point for Garay. He resigned in protest and had harsh words for the prime minister.
You, as the prime minister, came with the revolution. Instead of being in the line of the revolutionists, you became in the line of the overthrown people. And I will not cooperate with that. So I resigned.
Now the education system is a big mess, and reforms have stalled. Here's Muhammad Hassan Muhammad, the parent again. He says there's been a lot of confusion for parents and schools. Some teachers are still using the new curriculum, but just ripped out the controversial pages. Others have gone back to the old one. For many, it's a disappointing example of the challenges to reform, a loss especially felt by young Christians like Kazan Rahman Kabazi. Kabazi says it wasn't easy being a Christian student in Sudan. He had to memorize Quranic verses in all of his classes, but nothing about his own religion was taught in schools. If Islam is part of the curriculum, he says, Christianity should be too, because Christians are also part of Sudan. Next week, we'll hear more about the experience of Christians and other religious minorities in Sudan since the 2019 revolution. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Khartoum.
Sacred Nation, our ongoing series about religion and nationalism, is funded by the Henry Luce Foundation. Check it out at theworld.org/sacrednation. Indonesia is a country whose people are spread out across thousands of islands, which makes a sudden surge of COVID especially troubling. Indonesia is logging more than 50,000 new reported cases per day. That is currently the highest rate in the world. Experts also believe the actual number is much higher. The virus is spreading throughout Southeast Asia more generally. The World's Patrick Nguyen covers the region for us. We spoke earlier today about how bad things have gotten in Indonesia.
It's pretty out of control, Marco. They've got hospitals running out of oxygen, patients being treated in parking lots of hospitals, people dying at home with no care. And Indonesia is a mostly Muslim country, so they bury their dead. And there are these reports that gravediggers are totally overwhelmed. They just can't dig graves fast enough. The reason it's so bad is the rate of people getting COVID in Indonesia is so fast. It's doubled since the beginning of this month. And experts say it isn't even close to peaking yet.
So this is a year and a half since the pandemic started. We keep seeing these situations of clusters just spreading so quickly and fast. Mm-hmm. Why is it spreading so fast?
Delta is a part of it. Another big part of it in Indonesia is they have a lot of people, 270 million people, fourth biggest country in the world, and a lot of them are concentrated on one island, Java, which is one of the most densely populated places in the world. The capital, Jakarta, is there, this incredibly crowded, bustling city where people live in close quarters, especially poor people, and they can't get away from each other and self-isolate even if they wanted to.
So what's the Indonesian government done to bring this really troubling situation under control?
Well, obviously they're vaccinating, but they don't have enough vaccines. Only 15% of Indonesians have even one dose. There are lockdowns, but only in urban areas on the island of Java, where the capital, Jakarta, is located, and also Bali, that famous tropical island.
Mm.
But it's not a nationwide lockdown. Last week, the president of Indonesia, Joko Widodo, he said, quote, "We can learn from what happened in India, but some would say he didn't lock down cities fast enough, not even as fast as India did. And so now infection rates are on par with what we saw in parts of India recently. And then once it reaches that point, it becomes almost uncontainable."
So as I said, the virus is spreading throughout Southeast Asia generally. Looking at your home base, Patrick, Thailand, there have been protests this week related to COVID. What's going on there?
Yeah, Thailand is seeing a really nasty surge, again, thanks to the Delta variant. They were actually at a breaking point before because the economy is in tatters. And now that the surge has hit, a lockdown is about to kick in and they're about to stop all domestic flights, further hurting the economy of Thailand. And there's just so much anger because people in Thailand have invested hope in a big vaccine rollout, which the government promised it would be smooth. It hasn't been smooth. It's been chaotic. You'll have people signing up for a vaccine and their appointment gets canceled because the government just doesn't have enough vaccines. And so a lot of the anger comes from the overpromising. It's unclear if the government can deliver all of the vaccines it has promised. The prime minister said he would open up the country to tourists by October. I don't see how that's possible at this point. So it'll probably get worse in Thailand before it gets better.
And Patrick, if we cast our eyes just over the border from Thailand to Myanmar, you've been covering the military coup since it happened in February.
Yeah.
And on top of that, now there's a dire COVID situation, too. What's the deal in Myanmar?
In Myanmar, the government, after the military coup, is not really functioning. And since then, the country has spiraled into madness with people getting shot in the streets, schools and hospitals shut down or occupied by troops, civilians joining resistance cells to fight back. It could be fairly described as a civil war at this point. So can you imagine a worse situation to have a COVID surge? That is happening. Citizens are just fending for themselves, very few vaccines, hospitals barely functioning, the military junta barely testing people. And so what I see in Myanmar from over the border are long lines of people desperate to fill up oxygen tanks just to keep their relatives alive. And because the military is so incompetent, they are not participating in helping people refill those tanks at all. So we probably don't even know how horrible it is because the government isn't competent enough to give us an accurate picture on the ground.
The World's Patrick Nguyen covering COVID outbreaks across Southeast Asia. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Over the weekend, thousands of Cubans attended a rally in Havana. This time it was pro-government supporters who came out. They held up pictures of the late Fidel Castro and his brother Raul, still alive. They also denounced the U.S. trade embargo. Now, that rally follows huge protests that broke out last week when Cubans across the island expressed anger over food shortages, power outages, and a lack of COVID vaccines. People in those crowds were heard singing a chant inspired by this pop song. Patria y Vida, Homeland and Life, was recorded by some of Cuba's best-known rappers, and now they're coming out in full support of the anti-government demonstrations. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia has a backstory to the chant adopted by Cuban protesters.
Randy Malcolm is a rapper and one half of the Grammy-winning duo Gente de Zona. Their song Bailando with Enrique Iglesias topped Billboard's Hot Latin Songs for most of 2014. And in 2015, La Gozadera with Marc Anthony also hit the top of the Latin billboards. Randy Malcolm took my phone call as he made his way to the heart of Cuban dissidents in Miami, Little Havana. Malcolm says what's happening today is historic. These protests were the first time in 27 years that people in Cuba staged public demonstrations against the government. And even though Malcolm no longer lives in his native Cuba, the song he helped write, Patria y Vida, has become part of the movement. Malcolm says they started writing with another Cuban singer who lives off the island, Jotuel, and the result was very different than what they had planned originally. But it was an easy song to write, Malcolm says, because they just talked about their lives growing up in Cuba. Specifically, they talked about pro-communist literature forced on them in school.
Declaración de La Habana,
The songwriter zeroed in on a phrase Fidel Castro repeated over decades, saying Cubans should be willing to die for their country.
Patria o muerte.
Here's Castro in 1960, Patria o Muerte, Homeland or Death.
Patria o Muerte.
Again in 1989, Homeland or Death.
Patria o Muerte.
And in 1994.
Desde pequeño, desde que sale prácticamente del vientre de tu mamá.
They teach you this ever since you're a kid, Malcolm says, since you're in the womb, practically.
Para defender una Cuba de dictadores.
But Malcolm says they teach you to defend a Cuba that's for dictators, not for democracy or freedom of speech. And it wasn't only musicians off the island working on Patria y Vida. Artists in Cuba with the anti-censorship San Isidro movement also contributed. They decided to invert the old communist slogan and came up with Patria y Vida, Homeland and Life. Malcolm says when they first heard the song, they all cried like they were little kids. He says they knew Homeland and Life would resonate in Cuba. They just didn't predict the protests. The song has become a rallying cry. After Patria y Vida became popular, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel wrote on Twitter that insurgents were trying to erase the country's slogan, and the government, in response, released its own song. Cuban police officers moved quickly to arrest protesters by the dozens, sometimes violently. In Miami, Malcolm and his group Gente de Zona performed for people waving the Cuban flag.
Nosotros ahora no tenemos cabeza para hablar de otra cosa que no sea la libertad de Cuba.
Homeland and Life was the first time Gente de Zona took part in political protest. And Malcolm says that now they can't think about anything other than freedom in Cuba. He says the duo is putting concerts and new recording projects on hold indefinitely. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia.
The U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan is well underway. It is a complex operation. Yesterday, the Pentagon provided an update about some Afghans who worked with American forces and remain targets of the Taliban. Defense Department spokesperson John Kirby said that 700 applicants for special immigrant visas will be coming to the U.S. this week, along with some family members, bringing the total to 2,500 Afghans.
We're going to give these people a safe place to stay for a few days while they finish the processing that they have to finish before they can then be resettled elsewhere in the United States.
For some Afghans, that safe place will be Fort Lee, a U.S. Army base in Virginia. For the 700 Afghans, it's the end of a long line to get to the U.S.
It takes years to get through the process.
Chris Purdy works on the Veterans for American Ideals project at Human Rights First. He says roughly 17,000 other Afghans are still waiting for entry to the U.S. Interpreters like Jalil, we're just using his first name for his safety, he'll get his first sit-down with the U.S. government on Thursday in Kabul.
I'm getting ready for the interview day. Hopefully, we get our visa as soon as possible to get out of Afghanistan before September 11th.
September 11th, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks and President Biden's deadline for removing all U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Advocates for the interpreters, like Chris Purdy, say that this first group coming to Fort Lee marks an important milestone.
However, given that the administration has waited so long in the process and all U.S. military personnel are effectively out of the country right now, it's going to be very difficult for them to pull that off.
Pull it off, meaning get the remaining Afghans evacuated who helped the U.S. Lots of questions remain. Where will they go to finish their visa applications? And how long could that take? Questions that need to be answered soon as the clock ticks closer to the day when U.S. forces are gone from Afghanistan. Surfing is making its debut at the Tokyo Olympics. In Hawaii, the birthplace of surfing, that's cause for both celebration and concern. Concern that the big stage in Japan may cause people to lose sight of the roots of surfing and its enormous cultural importance for native Hawaiians. Kalani Ka'ana'ana has been working on this. He's the chief brand officer for the Hawaii Tourism Authority. They recently formed a surfing advisory committee to help spread the story of the sport's Hawaiian origins and significance. My colleague Carol Hills recently caught up with Kalani.
Kalani, what does it mean to you that surfing will be part of the Olympic Games for the first time?
Hello, everyone. You know, we're incredibly excited and proud. Duke Kahanamoku, the father of modern surfing, as many have called him, sort of prophesied that this would happen back when he was winning the Olympics in 1912. And so it's really a proud day that vision is coming to fruition.
And of course, he was not competing in surfing then. He was a swimmer, wasn't he?
Absolutely, yes.
Now, I want to get into the history you mentioned of surfing. Tell us a bit about the origins of surfing.
Yeah, so surfing began long before any sort of what we might consider modern competitive surfing began in Hawaii centuries ago. It was the sport and pastime of chiefs and something that became beloved by all and something that we shared with the world. And so like Duke taught us and many others before him, really surfing is about sharing aloha. It's about taking care of our oceans and reefs, and it's about taking care of each other.
Now, how does the history of colonization relate to the concerns that Hawaiians feel over surfing today?
Surfing to us is just one more thing in the list of things that has been separated from our cultural heritage, our people, and our sovereignty. And so the dispossession of land, dispossession of our language, the theft of our country, those are all things that contribute to how I think we feel today. And surfing and its competitive nature and it turning into a $10 billion industry globally is just another example of things being dispossessed from Native Hawaiians, and that the connections to and the deeper meanings of our cultural practices often get bastardized or commodified and taken out of their original context.
I know that surfers from Hawaii in this upcoming Olympics, in this first ever when surfing is included, they're going to be surfing under the U.S. flag. And that's a bit of a bone of contention. Why?
Traditionally, surfing organizations like WSL and the others have allowed Hawaiian surfers and surfers from Hawaii to fly the Hawaiian flag or wear the Hawaiian flag on their sleeve, recognizing that they are Hawaii surfers. In the Olympics, they'll be representing the United States. And I think it just goes back to this broader understanding of our complex political history and the illegal overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom. And so I think that all of that bleeds through to today. And so outrigger canoe paddling, surfing, and in other arenas, Hawaiians are still recognized as Hawaiians and represent Hawaii and use the Hawaiian flag as a symbol of that. But in the Olympics, aren't fully recognized and obviously are competing for and on behalf of the U.S. team.
Was there any attempt to allow the Hawaiian competitors in surfing at the Olympics to fly the Hawaiian flag?
Let me separate two things. So I think that there were requests made. I'm not totally sure because I wasn't in those meetings. Separately, apart from the athletes themselves, I know that there were a group of Native Hawaiians who requested of the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, for a Hawaiian national surfing team, and the request wasn't heard.
Your organization has formed a surfing advisory committee to bring the history of surfing to the forefront. How are you hoping to do that?
For us at the Hawaii Tourism Authority, we have a unique ability and responsibility to be destination stewards and better storytellers. And so we feel that if we're going to represent Hawaii as a destination, which is our role within state government, that we need to be authentic and we need to be accurate in the stories that we tell. And so recognizing the complexity and oftentimes the uncomfortable conversations that come with things like sovereignty, we really are honoring the true complexity of this place and being good storytellers as we share about the Hawaiian Islands.
Kalani, are there any Native Hawaiians on the U.S. surfing team that will be competing at the Olympic Games?
Yes, Carissa Moore is a proud Native Hawaiian, and we're so proud of her and the rest of the team.
Do you plan to watch the surfing competition at the Olympics?
Absolutely.
And I have to ask, will you be flying your Hawaiian flag as you watch it?
Of course.
I wouldn't be surprised if somebody snuck in a Hawaiian flag at the Olympics. I'm just thinking it's going to show up.
You know, the other thing, too, is we have a deep, deep connection with Japan. In the Hawaiian kingdom. And so actually King Kalakaua actually traveled to Japan and met with Emperor Meiji and signed treaties of commerce and amity. And so we have deep, deep connections. So I wouldn't be surprised if somebody from Japan snuck in a Hawaiian flag too.
Thanks, Kalani.
Aloha, mahalo, take care.
My colleague Carol Hills there speaking with Kalani Ka'ana'ana from the Hawaiian Tourism Authority, sharing with us how native Hawaiians see the debut of surfing at the upcoming Tokyo Olympics. Spectators are banned from Olympic venues because of COVID, so for many visitors, the only way to get a glimpse of the Games is by bus. Your own virtual driving tour of the Tokyo Games, our photo essay, is at theworld.org. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We're back with you tomorrow.